Due to a technical failure, the beginning of our panel, Civil Pleading Standards After Iqbal, was not recorded. Our moderator, Professor Robin Efron of Brooklyn Law School, introduced our four participants. They included Professor Suja Thomas of the University of Illinois College of Law, Professor Adam Steinman of the University of Cincinnati College of Law, Professor Stephen Burbank of the University of Pennsylvania Law School, and Professor Susanna Sherry of Vanderbilt Law School. Our recording begins partway through Professor Thomas's remarks.
And so if you look at then the motion to dismiss, this new motion to dismiss, and compare it to the demurrer of the pleadings and the demurrer of evidence, I say that you don't really have a connect. That under this new motion to dismiss, there's this sort of plausibility sufficiency analysis. Whereas under the motion, the demurrer of the pleadings and demurrer of the evidence, you actually accepted the facts and the conclusions as true, including that which was implausible. The next thing I do in the paper is I look at the substance of the common law and compare the substance of the common law to the new motion to dismiss, because the Supreme Court has said we have to look at not just the individual procedures, we have to look at the substance. And even though the Supreme Court itself hasn't derived that substance, as I said, I did some work here too. So in a previous paper, I derived these core principles. And so under the first core principle, we have one party could admit the allegations or the conclusions of the evidence of the other party, or the parties could leave the determination of the facts to the jury. A court itself never decided the case without a determination of the facts by the parties or the jury, however improbable the evidence was. And so that's sort of what you see with both the demurrer to the evidence and demurrer to the pleadings, that a judge can't actually determine the actual case unless you admit the facts and the conclusions of the pleadings or the actual evidence that was presented, including that which was implausible. Now, the second slide, I think, says a lot about the core principles of the common law. Second, only after parties presented evidence at the trial and only after jury rendered a verdict would a court ever determine whether the evidence was sufficient to support a jury verdict. Where the court decided the evidence was insufficient, the court would order a new trial. Another jury would actually determine the facts and decide which party won. And so under the common law, a procedure that I didn't mention, there was another procedure called the new trial, a procedure that we have now. And there was a sufficiency of the evidence determination there, but there had to be another trial. Once after the there was actually a trial, there was a sufficiency, there could be a sufficiency of the evidence determination, but the court would order a new trial. And so these are sort of the two, I would say right now, core principles of the common law. And then I think if you look at and you compare the common law to the new motion to dismiss, that again you see that there's a disconnect. Only under the common law could there be some kind of sufficiency, and I would say similar to plausibility analysis, if there had been a trial already, and if that was the case, it had to be sent to a new trial. So on the basis of looking at the different procedures under the common law, and the demurrer of the pleadings and the demurrer of evidence were two of the procedures, and I looked at a number of other ones, as well as the substance of the common law, I concluded that the motion to dismiss was unconstitutional. And lastly, I'll just sort of say before I turn it over to Steve, is that if the motion to dismiss required the acceptance of facts and inferences as true, I say that then the motion to dismiss would be constitutional, which is what I said in my sort of previous paper before the standard was changed. And this was the motion to dismiss under Conley versus Gibson. Thanks.
I'm going to talk about a somewhat different aspect of Twombly and Iqbal, namely getting rid of them. In early December, I testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee at a hearing that was called to address the important question whether Twombly and Iqbal are denying Americans access to court. And although I praised Senator Specter for his early action in introducing a bill to overrule the court's decisions, thus signaling concern to the bench, the bar, and the public, and stimulating interest in debate, I argue in favor of an alternative that I included as an appendix to my prepared statement. Essentially, the alternative would restore the law to what it was on May 20th, 2007, which is the day before the first of these two cases was decided. I took inspiration in that from a provision in the 1991 Civil Rights Act that is very similar, and I also took inspiration from the dialogue that Specter's bill and a House bill that was subsequently introduced had stimulated. The alternative that I proposed reflects my view that first, the court's decisions in Twombly and Iqbal resulted from a process that for this purpose was both illegitimate and inadequate. Second, although legislation is a legitimate process for amending the federal rules of civil procedure, the Enabling Act process is usually to be preferred and is preferable in this instance, at least as a basis for ultimate legislative judgment. And third, nonetheless, legislative action is required now to prevent irreparable injury pending the completion of the Enabling Act process. Now, the process leading to Twombly and Iqbal, adjudication under Article 3, and hence the decisions themselves, were illegitimate because they effected consequential changes to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure without affording Congress the opportunity to review and, if necessary, to block the new policy choices contained in those decisions before they became effective. I usually avoid the term judicial activism because, in my experience, people who use it do so as a label to describe decisions that they don't like without reference to an objective standard. Twombly and particularly Iqbal are examples of judicial activism, I contend, according to an objective standard, namely that's contained in the Enabling Act and in the court's own previous decisions distinguishing judicial interpretation from judicial amendment of the federal rules. For the court has told us that, quote, we are bound to follow a federal rule as we understood it upon its adoption, and we are not free to alter it except through the process prescribed by Congress in the Rules Enabling Act, end quote. Twombly and Iqbal's defenders must pretend that, quote, interpretation, end quote, is a process sufficiently capacious to accommodate, first, the abandonment of the system of notice pleading that the drafters of the original federal rules intended, that Congress and the bar were told in 1938 had been implemented in the federal rules, and that the Supreme Court embraced as early as 1947. Second, its replacement by a system of complaint parsing that is hard, if not impossible, to distinguish from the complaint parsing under code pleading that the drafters of the federal rules explicitly rejected. Third, a wholly new general requirement of plausibility. And fourth, the demonstrable rewriting of Rule 9B. I understand that the difference between interpretation and judicial lawmaking is one of degree rather than kind, but here the degree of separation approaches 180. Comparing the role that those who wrote the federal rules envisioned for pleading and what they thought could fairly be demanded of plaintiffs filing complaints with the new world celebrated by Twombly and Iqbal's defenders leaves no doubt that the court in those cases ignored previous acknowledgments that it has, quote, no power to rewrite the rules by judicial interpretation, end quote. Even before Iqbal, Judges Posner and Easterbrook and Professor Epstein, who are not known for bleeding hearts, appeared to agree. One can only wonder at the spectacle of justices who deride a living constitution, enthusiastically embracing living federal rules. From this perspective, the legislation I favor would bring back the federal rules in exile. The process, and hence the decisions, were inadequate as opposed to illegitimate because adjudication did not give the court and the justices otherwise lacked the information, experience, and breadth of perspectives that are necessary for wise prospective lawmaking about matters as fundamental as access to court and private enforcement of public law. Consider in that regard the Twombly Court's discussion of the costs of discovery. Eschewing any reference to systematic as opposed to anecdotal data, the majority relied to a great extent on an article by Judge Easterbrook that is heavy on theory and light on facts. Not only was that article's analysis predicated on a law and economics model of so-called impositional discovery, it was published in 1989, before substantial changes to the discovery rules in 1993, 2000, and 2006, changes that the Twombly Court ignored. As I observed about the Seventh Circuit's attempt to turn Rule 11 into a fee-shifting statute in the 1980s, theory is an irresponsible basis for lawmaking about something as important as access to court. And it is especially irresponsible when the lawmaking involves judicial amendment of a rule. Finally, in this aspect, quite apart from systematic empirical research, consideration of many of the policy questions implicated in Twombly and Iqbal would have benefited from a base of experience with federal trial court litigation broader than that possessed by the members of the Supreme Court, almost all of which predated Justice Stevens's appointment in 1975. Congress does not suffer from the deficits in democratic accountability of the court's decisions in Twombly and Iqbal. Rather than itself running the risk of legislating pleading law on the basis of incomplete information and partial perspectives, however. Congress should insist on respect for the process that it has prescribed in the Enabling Act, as amended, in delegating legislative power to the court to make prospective supervisory rules. Some legislation, I believe, however, is necessary now to forestall the damage that the court's decisions could do in the 3 to 4 years that it will take the Judicial Conference's rules committees properly to address the issues under the Enabling Act process. Of course, we don't know yet. We don't have enough knowledge about the impact of Twombly and Iqbal to state with confidence that they will cause a radical change in litigation behavior or the results of litigation. Still, I include in an appendix to my prepared statement a sample of cases, and there are a lot of them, in which the courts have either suggested or explicitly stated that complaints that they were dismissing would not have been dismissed under prior law. And early empirical work, I'm referring in particular to a study by Professor Patricia Hattemeyer, suggests that Twombly and Iqbal have had a disproportionately adverse impact on the usual victims of procedural reform, namely civil rights plaintiffs. Hattemeyer's study is, to be sure, has its problems. It suffers from the biases of all empirical work that is based on published decisions. But I'm less concerned about that in this context than I am normally, because in my view, the relevant question should be, who should bear the risk of irreparable injury as a result of the Supreme Court's improvident decisions? In my view, it should not be those usual victims of procedural reform, and it should not be the beneficiaries, or I should say the intended beneficiaries, of federal statutes that Congress designed to be enforced through private civil litigation. Finally, although the approach taken in my proposed substitute amendment would necessarily yield some uncertainty and inconsistency, they could not, in my view, be any greater than, if as great as, the uncertainty and inconsistency that new statutory standards would engender, or that Iqbal's capricious complaint parsing and privileging of judicial experience and common sense have already created. Most risible of all the arguments that I have heard against the status quo approach is that it will, quote, guarantee inconsistency, end quote, as if Twombly and Iqbal will bring about consistency. I prefer the devil I know to the devil I do not know, at least until such time as there has been a thorough, open, and democratically accountable lawmaking process that justifies installing a new prince of the nether regions.
I'm not sure how to follow that. But what I'm going to say is that even if you don't care about access to courts, and even if you don't care about civil rights plaintiffs, I'm going to give you 5 reasons why members of the Federalist Society in particular should oppose both Iqbal and Twombly, because I believe, and I'm going to explain why, that Iqbal and Twombly are contrary to everything that the Federalist Society stands for. So, the Federalist Society is committed to, among other things, an originalism as a method of interpretation. And as Suja Thomas showed, this is Iqbal and Twombly are inconsistent with the original intent of the founding generation in enacting the adopting the Seventh Amendment. And as Steve, I think, briefly showed, and as he has showed in his writing more fully, it is also inconsistent with the original intent of the drafters of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. So we essentially have an illegitimate interpretation of the Constitution by Federalist Society standards, and an illegitimate interpretation of a statutory product by Federalist Society standards. The Federalist Society is second committed to allocating authority to the people and their representatives rather than to judges. And in deciding the cases, as Steve suggested, the Supreme Court usurped the authority of Congress and its delegated agents under the Rules Enabling Act. And as I think Suja implied, the consequence of the cases will be to transfer power from juries, from the people, to judges. So again, the second Federalist Society commitment that Twombly and Iqbal are inconsistent with is the commitment to give authority to the people and their elected representatives rather than to unelected federal judges. This does exactly the reverse. Third, the Federalist Society is, I believe, committed to reducing judicial discretion by the in particular particular by the use of clear and formal rules. Justice Scalia is obviously one of the strongest advocates of both the reduction of judicial discretion and the use of clear and formal rules, which makes it somewhat ironic that he joined the Twombly and Iqbal majorities. And I think, as I said, the cases are inconsistent. They will increase. First of all, it is not a clear and formal rule. As Steve said, plausibility is a wholly new standard. If you look at the lower court cases, lower court judges have no idea what to make of the standard. It is they already have difficulty deciphering what Twombly and Iqbal mean, much less applying it. So it is not a clear and formal rule. And I think that it will increase judicial discretion. One of the ways to define judicial discretion, particularly at the district court level, is to ask whether there's likely to be oversight. Are the courts of appeals likely to police the discretion of the district courts? If not, then the district courts are going to have more discretion. And I think one of the things that Twombly and Iqbal do is make it highly unlikely that a district court judge will be reversed no matter what she does, whether she grants the motion to dismiss or she denies the motion to dismiss. In most cases, either that decision will not be appealable at all, or the standard of review will be such that, and the standard of the motion will be such that a court of appeals is unlikely to disturb the district court's decision. So it the combination of an unclear rule and the decrease in oversight is going to lead to a tremendous amount of judicial discretion. Fourth commitment, I think, of the Federalist Society is to reducing the cost of litigation. And I think that these cases are more likely to increase the cost of litigation on both sides, but especially for defendants, because what used to be a routine but basically unimportant motion, that is, a 12B6 motion was made in every case, but it was a throwaway motion. No lawyer time was expended on it. It was boilerplate. It was not expensive. Now that routine motion is going to become fiercely litigated in every case on both sides. And although some of those cases may be dismissed, and again, here we go back to the lack of clarity of the rule and the increased discretion, it's hard to tell how many of those cases will be dismissed. Some of them will be dismissed, but I don't think enough of them will be dismissed to offset the increased cost in every case as the motion to dismiss becomes a major battle instead of a minor and routine skirmish. Fifth, I think the Federalist Society, and most specifically, the Federalist Society is committed to deterring frivolous litigation, and I think in one sense that is the strongest justification that has been offered for Iqbal and Twombly by both the court and its defenders. But I think paradoxically there is a good chance that these decisions will increase truly frivolous litigation, and by that I mean litigation that's filed in bad faith. That is, litigation where the plaintiffs pretty much know that they don't have a case, but they figure that they can extort a settlement by filing a case. Now, it may reduce some litigation or get rid of very early some litigation that is weak, but not bad faith, not frivolous. So why might these decisions increase the filing of truly frivolous bad faith litigation? It's because the information on whether the bad faith plaintiff's gamble will pay off comes earlier, before the plaintiff has expended very much. So it used to be that for a bad faith plaintiff, a frivolous plaintiff, a plaintiff who was playing only to extort a settlement but knew that they had no hope of winning, for that plaintiff to prevail, that plaintiff had to be willing to pay the costs through summary judgment motion. Now, those costs might not have been as much as the costs on the defendant, but there were costs. Now, such a bad faith plaintiff going in only has to pay the costs through the motion to dismiss. And if the motion to dismiss is granted, well, you tried, you lost, that's okay. But if the motion to dismiss is not granted, that sends a powerful signal, and the case will almost certainly settle. Basically, so plaintiffs who have actual cases but somewhat uncertain may be deterred, but the plaintiffs who are just playing the game to see if they can bluff to a win will not be deterred, because essentially what the court has now done is reduced the initial ante. The initial ante used to be a willingness to litigate through the summary judgment stage. Now the initial ante is only a willingness to litigate through the 12B6 stage. Basically, they get to see, these bad faith plaintiffs get to see more cards before they have to pay the big bet. And so they're going to be more willing to do that, which is why I think there is a good chance that the truly frivolous litigation, as opposed to the maybe weak but we don't know litigation, the truly extortionate litigation is likely to be increased under this standard rather than decreased. Now, I don't know whether there's actually a problem with frivolous litigation, but if there is, and if there is, I don't know what the answer is, but I do know that this, if there is a problem with frivolous litigation, this is not the answer to it. Thank you.
All right, I'm going to talk, approach this problem from a little bit of a different perspective, a lot of these arguments are in an article I'm working on. It'll be coming out in the Stanford Law Review in May. I'd love it if people want to look at an ISSRN and provide me comments on this talk or on the paper. My focus here is to say there's a lot of ambiguity in Iqbal and Twombly, in part because the court didn't do a very good job writing these opinions. But I actually think that ambiguity might provide a different way out of the situation we are in, which is if we read those cases carefully and if we read them faithfully in light of what the court itself has said, both in these decisions and in terms of what it has said generally about how its decisions are supposed to fit together over time, the answer is a framework that does not have to be that different from the previous one. Now, there are a lot of examples of courts not doing that. And leading to the kinds of problems that have been identified by the speakers. But I'd like to put forward a theory by which we can avoid some of those problems. So let me start with some first principles. A lot has been said about what Twombly and Iqbal have done to the previous case law of the Supreme Court. But the fact is, it only deviated from one phrase in a previous Supreme Court decision, and the others, a lot of very lenient notice pleading oriented cases, remain good law. So let me talk about that one phrase. It's the phrase from Conley versus Gibson that a complaint should not be dismissed for failure to state a claim unless it appears beyond doubt that the plaintiff can prove no set of facts in support of his claim. Now, I don't think this phrase was ever taken literally, and I actually give Justice Souter credit for criticizing it. So just imagine the following complaint. Paragraph 1, jurisdictional statement. Paragraph 2, the planet Earth is round. That's it. Can we really say beyond doubt that the plaintiff can prove no set of facts in support of his claim? Any number of actionable facts would be consistent with the Earth being round. So in my mind, the abrogation of that language is not all that troubling. What's far more telling, actually, is that Twombly cited with approval really the core language from Conley versus Gibson, was that the complaint must merely give a defendant fair notice of what the claim is and the grounds upon which it rests. Also, the court did not challenge other exemplars of the notice pleading framework, cases like Swierkiewicz and Leatherman. I won't bore you with the details of those cases. Well, maybe I will in a minute. But this is significant because, as a general matter, the court has made very clear, talking to the lower courts, that only it has the prerogative of overruling its decisions. And so even if there are potential inconsistencies, essentially, there's a duty to reconcile those unless and until the Supreme Court itself comes along and says, Swierkiewicz is no longer good law. The fair notice standard of Conley is no longer good law. My second first principle, and I'm not sure if that's an oxymoron or not, concerns what I think is the most controversial aspect doctrinally of Twombly and Iqbal, which is this inquiry into the plausibility of a plaintiff's claim. And I agree with the panelists that there are real problems with that inquiry. But I think if we read Twombly and Iqbal faithfully and carefully, plausibility really isn't the primary inquiry here. And at the 12B6 phase, it can actually fall away entirely. Okay, one thing Iqbal did was identify that there's really a two-step framework going on here. First, the court identifies allegations that are mere legal conclusions, that are conclusory allegations. And those don't need to be accepted as true at the pleadings phase. Second step is to look at the remaining allegations and accept them all as true. And then ask, do they plausibly suggest an entitlement to relief? So Iqbal itself makes clear that if the allegation is non-conclusory, it must be accepted as true without regard to plausibility. And if the crucial allegations, and they were in Twombly an allegation of an anti-competitive conspiracy, in Iqbal an allegation of a willful and malicious agreement by Ashcroft, Mueller, and nine others to treat the plaintiff with harsh conditions of confinement as a result of his race, religion, and national origin, had those allegations not been disregarded as conclusory, plausibility would have been irrelevant. And let me illustrate how that happens, okay? Let's assume that we have this crucial issue X. So in Twombly, it's the existence of a conspiracy. If the plaintiff provides a non-conclusory allegation of that conspiracy, then Iqbal's step two becomes, assuming X is true, is it plausible that X happened? Now, as a matter of pure logic, the answer has to be yes, because it's telling you have to assume that X happened, that it's true. The plausibility inquiry only comes into play if you have some crucial allegation that gets rejected as conclusory, and then you have to reason, well, given what's remaining, is it plausible that that now missing allegation can be established? So even if you're skeptical about the plausibility inquiry, as I am and many of my co-panelists are, it falls away if the plaintiff can avoid the scarlet sea of conclusoriness. All right, so this is, I think, where we might be able to solve this problem. And it involves getting into this question of what exactly is a legal conclusion for purposes of what you might call Iqbal step one. The hitch here is that the Supreme Court in Twombly and Iqbal didn't provide much explanation for why the crucial allegations in those cases could be deemed to be mere legal conclusions. And I actually think this is the best and the worst part of these decisions. It's bad because that decision to deem them conclusory was a fundamental prerequisite for everything that came after, including this much maligned plausibility inquiry. So it would have been nice if the court had given us some guidance on that. But the silver lining here is that the court's omission gives lower courts and folks like us the opportunity to weigh in and fill the void. What I think is crucial in order to make sense and effectuate these two principles is to discount and dismiss what I think would be a profoundly mistaken way to read Twombly and Iqbal. And here's what that mistaken view is. The idea that a complaint needs to contain some kind of evidentiary support for its allegations, to whatever probability threshold, whether it's plausibility or something lower or something higher, and that without such evidentiary support, the allegation's conclusory. This is the wrong way to read Twombly and Iqbal, and I'll give you a couple reasons why. The first is, those decisions themselves accepted some allegations in the complaints as true without regard to whether there were any additional allegations supporting their truth. So to give you an example, Twombly contained a lot of allegations about how the Baby Bells engaged in parallel conduct with one another. It never for a second says, well, wait, is there supporting allegations for those allegations? No, they accepted them as true. They were non-conclusory. Second, I think building on my first principle, is the Swierkiewicz case, which is still good law, actually explicitly confronted this question of whether a complaint needs to raise enough inferences of the ultimate allegation. And in that case, it was an employment discrimination case, and the issue was there actually invidious discrimination? And the court said that's not what pleadings are about. I won't bore you with the forms of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, but they contain some very bare-bones allegations on everything ranging from negligence to patent infringement that could not at all be reconciled with a reading of these cases that requires a complaint to contain some kind of evidentiary support. So then what does conclusory mean? And I think this is the tricky issue, but we're sort of forced here by the court's own actions, because it's written an opinion that cannot set aside these earlier cases, cannot set aside these exemplars of notice pleading because of what the court has told us. But yet, we need to figure out why those crucial allegations in Twombly and Iqbal were problematic. So I'll just give you one example. I'll talk about Twombly, for example. Since I know we want to leave time for Q&A. Again, the crucial allegation there was that the defendants had entered into a contract combination or conspiracy. Now, by definition, a conspiracy to engage in parallel conduct has to come before the parallel conduct itself. Yet, the way this complaint was phrased, the conspiracy allegation came afterwards, and it was phrased in this way that suggested that the conspiracy derived from the parallel conduct rather than the other way around. It said that the conspiracy allegation was, quote, in light of, unquote, the parallel conduct. And Souter, in the majority opinion, emphasized this fact and said that because of that, the plaintiffs hadn't made an independent allegation of actual agreement. Now, my own view is that Souter misunderstood the complaint on this issue, that there were legitimate reasons why the Twombly complaint was phrased that way. But in terms of understanding what this means going forward, what really makes an allegation conclusory, it's clear that his concern was a transactional one. And let me tell you what I mean by that. It's not a problem that there isn't supporting evidence. The problem is when the allegation fails to identify adequately the real-world acts or events, the transactions or occurrences, if you will, that give rise to the claim. It's the failure to identify what happened, not a failure to show to whatever probability threshold that you can prove it. And I think if we take an approach like this, and I'll admit that there are tricky line drawing problems, but if we take this approach, I'm not sure we're necessarily that far off from the notice pleading framework that has prevailed. Now, someone will say, well, but wait, isn't the recognition that courts can disregard conclusory allegations a fundamental break from the old framework? I don't think that's true, because notice pleading itself was never a blank check. A plaintiff could never just say, defendant violated my rights in a way that entitles me to relief. That would never have to be accepted as true, even before Twombly. Now, pre-Twombly, the courts would have said, well, that allegation fails to provide sufficient notice. But the fact is, any approach to pleading that permits a court to disregard allegations because they lack some information the court deems necessary could be framed in terms of what fair notice is. So to say that an allegation is conclusory because it lacks X is no different than saying that fair notice requires the defendant to be informed of X. And this is exactly why Charles Clark, dean of the Yale Law School, Second Circuit judge, and author largely of these federal rules, he bristled at the idea that the federal rules pleading standard was about notice, precisely because it begged the question of what notice was required. And if it required lots of details, that's not much of an advancement in his mind. So I think the need to define what conclusory means in this post-Iqbal era is going to force courts to confront this crucial question, which is what exactly must a complaint have in order for a particular allegation to be accepted as true. I'll wrap things up. Let me just say one more point before I finish up. I've certainly got the reaction sometimes that this is sort of a naive take on things, that I should be a lot more realistic about what the courts is endeavoring to do here, and that in fact the majorities in these cases are trying to do precisely what folks have criticized these decisions for, which is allow defendants, largely corporate and business interests, to avoid civil accountability. But I'm not sure that that's what was really going on here. I think if it was, why not overrule Swierkiewicz? Why not overrule the fair notice standard in Conley? Instead, they just overruled that problematic no set of facts language. I think what was going on, and it doesn't paint a particularly a good picture of the court, is that these are fairly result-oriented decisions that were motivated by the facts of these cases, rather than a desire to remake pleading standards generally. So Twombly was a mammoth class action involving nearly everyone who's ever had a phone. It would have lined the pockets of the Milbert Weiss firm, which had been indicted one month before cert had been granted. And then Iqbal was a lawsuit that was seeking civil damages against the two highest-ranking law enforcement officials in the country in response to what the court said was a national security emergency unprecedented in the history of the American Republic. So my sense is, this is not to praise the court in any sense, but I think we can not only read these cases and that we're obligated to read these cases to reconcile them with the previous regime, but that there's also an explanation for why the court was particularly prickly about these cases. And I think that also helps, at least as sort of a realpolitik matter, explain that there might be hope when that next case comes, that we'll get some sort of clarification that brings us closer to the original pleading framework.
Well, thanks to everyone for their comments. So now we'll open it up to questions. And I thought I'd start by asking the panelists themselves if you would like to respond to anything that you all have said to each other.
Actually, I would. And the only person I need to respond to is Adam, since he was the only one who spoke after me. And I want to make one comment and ask one question. The comment is, I think this was a stealth overruling of Swierkiewicz and Leatherman and the other cases that you talked about. I think the court said one thing and did another. It said it wasn't overruling Swierkiewicz, but it did. I think that sooner or later they will explicitly overrule Swierkiewicz, and I think that they will point to the confusion in the lower courts as a reason for doing so. Because the lower courts can't seem to apply Swierkiewicz, so we might as well overrule it. And that, of course, is a good reason to overrule a case, but not when...
Third Circuit already says it's been overruled.
Third Circuit already says it's been overruled. I think they're essentially right. But, I mean, it's good to overrule cases that lower courts can't understand, except when it's the Supreme Court's intervening cases that create the confusion. The question is, what could Iqbal have pled that would not be conclusory, but would give rise to a plausible claim for relief? He alleged that he was singled out for special treatment. He alleged that Ashcroft and Mueller designed, approved, and implemented the plan under which he was singled out.
The principal architect.
And he alleged that they did so out of a discriminatory motive. What more could he have alleged?
So that's a great question. Your first point is a great one as well. Let me see if I can respond to those. With respect to Iqbal, often when I present these ideas, I feel like I'm sort of an apologist for the Iqbal decision, and that's not at all my intent here. But I think there are aspects of that complaint that, from a transactional standpoint, are qualitatively different from, say, Form 11, which says very clearly what happened. The defendant drove a car against the plaintiff. The problem with the Iqbal complaint, and this will get a little bit detailed, but first of all, Iqbal substantively constrained Bivens' liability in a very meaningful way. Frankly, it's not enough to be the supervisor or to be aware of unconstitutional discrimination. You have to be individually making discriminatory decisions, is essentially the way they read it, in order to trigger Bivens' liability. And this was the problem. I think it's paragraph 96 of the complaint says something along the lines of Ashcroft and Mueller and nine others willfully and maliciously agreed to subject Iqbal to these conditions of confinement as a matter on the basis of his race, religion, and national origin. The problem is it's very hard to see what exactly they did, and here's what I mean by that. There's a general background section that says, kind of, here are all the official policies. High level, low level, none of which are alleged to have been adopted for invidiously discriminatory reasons. Then we have Iqbal's confinement, and then all of a sudden we have this allegation that, oh, and there was a willful and malicious agreement to make this happen for invidious reasons. All I would want to see would be something to specify what exactly did they willfully and maliciously agree to do. Let's everyone go and only round up Muslims and treat them this way. If it was they did that for invidious reasons, I would say that's enough. If it was they made a personal order that Iqbal be treated this way, and they did it because of his national origin and his religion and his race, I would think that provides an adequate transactional narrative. If it was they created this entire hold-until-cleared policy, knowing that it was going to have an adverse effect on Arab Muslims, and they did it because of that adverse effect, that would be enough. What's ambiguous is this question of what they actually did, and because respondeat superior doesn't apply, it's much more crucial in a case like that than it is in a case like Swierkiewicz, where there is respondeat superior. Now, again, that's a fine line. I will acknowledge that. But we're obligated to draw that line, because you may be right that in that next case they overrule Swierkiewicz. But where we are now, we have to heed what the court has said, which is don't assume that we've overruled anything. And what I'm trying to suggest is one way that we might draw that line And again, I'm not necessarily happy we have to do it, but it's better than the alternative of assuming that we're now in a much stricter pleading regime.
It's, I admire Adam for an heroic effort to rescue these decisions from infamy. I don't agree with him, but nonetheless, if the lower courts are going to deal with these decisions, I'd rather have them deal with the way Adam suggests than the way a lot of them already are dealing with them, which is not the way he suggests. I think actually what we are seeing in some courts, some district courts in the Third Circuit, I know this is true, the judges are paying no attention to these decisions. And therefore, we have a process of lawlessness cubed. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean by that the lower courts, for a number of years, were paying no attention to Connolly and Gibson. They paid no attention to Leatherman's, and they paid no attention to Swierkiewicz. They continued, some of them, in the Sixth Circuit and the Eleventh Circuit particularly, to impose heightened pleading decisions, even though they knew they weren't supposed to do that. That's the first stage of lawlessness. The second stage of lawlessness, in my view, is Twombly and Iqbal themselves. I mean, no matter how hard one tries, one can't really argue persuasively that these cases are consistent with the Supreme Court's own prior decisions. You can't find evidence of the level of complaint parsing that you find, particularly in Iqbal, in the Supreme Court's prior decisions. You will not find a general plausibility requirement in the Supreme Court's prior decisions. And you will not find a repudiation of Rule 9b, either in the Supreme Court's prior decisions or in any lower court decision. They rewrote 9b. So that's lawlessness squared. Lawlessness cubed is in those district courts particularly where the courts are simply saying we're not going to follow this. But of course, in lots of other courts, they are following it or even taking it further, which means that we're back to the situation that we were in under Rule 11 in the decade between 1983 and 1993, and we're back to the situation that we're in with respect to Rule 56. We have a supposedly uniform rule that is radically disuniform depending upon what part of the country you're litigating in and what type of case you're litigating.
And did you want to respond?
No, no.
Okay. And I just wanted to add one other comment to what Adam said is, I think Adam concentrates on this also, accepting the facts as true, and I think essentially the courts actually, even though the court says you're supposed to do that, I think essentially the courts aren't accepting the facts as true.
Right, yeah, and I think that's right. There are different ways to articulate the conclusory versus non-conclusory line. Sometimes the court's talking about legal conclusions versus factual assertions. Mm. I think the court thinks it's accepting all the facts as true. The question is, what's a fact as opposed to a legal conclusion? Now, I actually try to avoid framing it in terms of facts because I think that's a notoriously fuzzy term. I'm sort of embracing, for better or worse, the court's use of the term conclusory. If I could ask a question to you, actually, I'm curious what, and again, this is sort of a very extreme example, but I talk, how would they have treated, in the common law, someone who came in and just said, the defendant violated the law in a way that entitles me to relief? I mean, would that have been enough to get to the jury? You talk in your paper about how conclusions have to be accepted as true. How would that have been treated? Is it demure or anything else?
Well, I mean, you'd typically sort of, put this in sort of with a form of action, and mm-hmm. and so there'd be some facts, mm-hmm. right? So I guess I don't know how far.
I guess this issue: what is a fact? Right? What is something that needed to be accepted as true then? I guess what I'm wondering is: were they struggling with those issues even then?
If you read the I think it's footnote 5 in Connolly against Gibson, which is a footnote that that explains what they mean by the no set of facts language that has become so notorious. You will find Clark's opinion in, what is it, DiGiulio. But you'll also find, and I think much more informative, an Eighth Circuit case written by Circuit Judge Sanborn, in which he goes through what the common law demur to the pleading was and also what the comparable motion was in equity, which is to dismiss for lack of equity, and notes that with respect, as I recall it, to a common law motion to dismiss, demur to the pleading, you actually, the court would disregard conclusory allegations. moving on then to 12b-6, he says, no, but that's not this system. We don't disregard conclusory allegations, because one of their major goals in pleading was to get away from this attempt, this metaphysical, arbitrary attempt to distinguish among facts, evidence, conclusions of law, etc. So the Form 9, if you look at the institutes right after the federal rules became effective, you'll find Clark dealing with an assertion by somebody who attended one of those institutes that what was then Form 9, Form 11, this is the defendant negligently drove his automobile into me. The person attending said that wouldn't be acceptable in any court in the country. And Clark says, oh, I wouldn't be so fast. First of all, we got it directly from Massachusetts, so it's acceptable in Massachusetts. And I actually think, he said, it would be acceptable in most places. The major question that would be raised has not to do with whether it states a claim, but whether it provides sufficient notice. So Clark was clearly drawing a distinction between a 12b-6 motion, a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim, and a 12e motion for a more particular statement. What Justice Souter for the court did in Twombly was join those two in a way that is really insensible from the point of view of the original federal rules. Whether it makes any sense going forward is another question.
So maybe if there are questions from here, Jason.
So most of the conversation has been about civil litigation in general, but there are lots of different kinds of civil cases. And so I wanted to ask, I guess I'll ask Professor Sherry about this. What are the distributional effects of the new framework across different kinds of civil cases? With respect to your argument that there's a lack of clarity in the new framework, is that more troublesome with respect to certain kinds of cases? And with respect to your predictions about where the new framework will lead, are there certain kinds of cases where those predictions are more likely to come true? In other words, is the new framework equally bad for securities litigation as it is for race discrimination in the employment context claims?
Well, Steve actually just handed me his notes because he has them as well, and I don't have notes on this. This is from Professor Patricia Hademeyer's article posted on SSRN, which I believe is called The Tao or Dao of Pleading, if you want to look at it. And she studied, I think it's 1,200 cases for like the 6 months before and after Twombly, and then six weeks after Iqbal, or maybe it was 2 years before before Twombly, 2 years after Twombly, and then 6 weeks after Iqbal, because she was already in process. And what she found is that I think the rate of granting increased over the three for every case, or for the cases overall, but not statistically significantly. The only statistically, and Steve, you can correct me if I'm wrong about my memory of this article, the only statistically significant increase was in civil rights cases from before Twombly to after Iqbal. That is, Twombly did not make, it made a difference, but it wasn't a statistically significant difference. Iqbal made a statistically significant difference. And I think this goes sort of to what Adam was saying, or trying very hard not to say. He kept defending Twombly, and we kept pushing him to defend Iqbal. I think that there are ways to defend Twombly, to say it really wasn't that big a change, other than actually overruling the Conley language. And I am sympathetic to the idea that the Conley language had not really been followed, and that it did deserve retirement. Although my favorite line in any of the cases is Justice Stevens' dissent in that case, where he says the judges, justices, should not rewrite all of the civil procedure case books overnight without any info. And that's because I am the author of a civil procedure case book. So Twombly, I think, there are ways to read it that are both consistent with prior cases and defensible in a lot of ways. I think Iqbal is the problematic case, and the lower courts seemed to be recognizing that Iqbal was the major change, in the sense that the study shows that the change in rates is mostly from before Twombly to after Iqbal, as opposed to the period in between.
I just add to that that if you think about it, the types of cases where these decisions will have major impact, they are going to be two types. One, where there are major resource major resource disequilibrium, and in particular where the plaintiff doesn't have the resources to do the sort of intensive pre-filing investigation that aggressive interpretations of Twombly and Iqbal require. That's not Milberg Weiss, by the way. I mean, one of the interesting ironies here may be like under the PSLRA, where it turned out that a legislation that was primarily designed to put them out of business only made them more successful, because they had the resources to comply with the heightened pleading requirements of the PSLRA, and a lot of the other firms did not. So that's one, and the other is where there's information asymmetry, as it's called. I mean, it may have occurred to you when Adam's going through the an attempt to answer the question of what could the plaintiff in Iqbal have pleaded. One of the things he didn't say, one of the other paragraphs in the complaint alleged that either Mueller or Ashcroft was the principal architect of the policy in question.
Ashcroft,
the principal architect. That was dismissed as conclusory. Well, what the hell could you have said without having been present during the meetings when these policies were reviewed? So those are two types of cases, and civil rights plaintiffs predictably are going to be screwed for both reasons.
Yeah, just to follow up on that just a little bit more, I would describe as sort of part of one of the types of cases where this is going to have the most bite is cases where the evidence of the defendant's wrongdoing or lack of wrongdoing is in the defendant's file cabinet or the defendant's head. And so any time a plaintiff will need evidence from the defendant's file cabinet or the defendant's head to prove the case, those are the cases that are going to feel the effect of Twombly. And I think civil rights cases are generally going to fall into that category. So again, none of this, it therefore should not be surprising what Professor Hademeyer found.
Greg?
I guess this will follow up.
Oh, you know, we'll wait for that.
So I actually have two questions. One of them will follow up on just the previous comments. And I work mostly in the patent area, and so one of the issues that I've been toying with is the effect of Twombly and Iqbal, specifically on inequitable conduct pleadings. Because it seems to me that usually the way inequitable conducts work is so-and-so didn't disclose X to the patent office, and then, of course, it's a two-prong issue, non-disclosure, and then, you know, and then sort of mens rea, why they didn't do it. And so that seems to me, usually you can't get to the second prong without discovery. And so it seems to me that under Twombly and Iqbal, this very well may be conclusory. And so, you know, I just would like to hear your views on how that will play out in the patent context. And then the second unrelated question is to Professor Thomas, is in your comparison between the old common law and today's motions, did you take into account, and if so, how, the fact that A, they didn't have really notice pleadings, and B, they didn't really have discovery. So when the courts ordered new trials, you could sort of keep bringing out more and more evidence until you sort of you got it right or the jury believed the other guy. While here, because we do have discovery, you sort of you know what the evidence will be at the second trial as well, and so it doesn't make sense to keep submitting it to the jury if at this stage the court found that their evidence is insufficient. How does that sort of play out?
I'd like to take a crack at the first question. As a theoretical matter, I think you've identified exactly another sort of case where Twombly and Iqbal might likely have bite, because it is exactly like a civil rights case in the sense that the plaintiff is alleging a particular state of mind of the defendant and cannot have any evidence of that. But I think what that does is highlight the discretion that is going to be that is given to the district court judges, I would not be surprised to find that the patent cases are not dismissed at a higher rate, whereas the civil rights cases might be, because I think a lot of this, especially with the word plausibility or plausible, even if the Supreme Court didn't mean it this way, judges are going to have in their heads, is this complaint plausible? Do I believe that this was done out of a discriminatory motive? Do I believe that most employers have discriminatory motives, or government agents, or whoever it is who's the defendant? As opposed to, do I believe that patent applicants have the mens rea of knowingly not disclosing? And I think that that is going to turn on the judge's view of the world, and that's a terrible kind of discretion to give law.
Yeah, note in that regard that a very interesting article published in the Harvard Law Review early this year by Dan Kahan and some colleagues on the Supreme Court summary judgment decision in the video police chase case, where they develop a concept which I was pleased to see was identified by the New York Times magazine as one of these interesting new ways of thinking called cognitive illiberalism, which is a fancy academic term for what Susanna just described. A lot of judges don't have the life experiences that will allow them to regard as plausible that which a number of Americans who don't have the sort of privileged backgrounds that they have experience every day. And it's one of the really insidious possibilities of these decisions is just feed right into the fact that our judges don't, many of them, don't have the life experiences that are coming before them in court, and that the trial process serves to discipline. And that's one of the things, if you read the history of the jury trial, if you hear some of the things that were said in the 19th century cases about one of wonderful things in anticipating this problem of how the evidence actually disciplines the priors that the judges would have about these cases. So, and note, finally, about fraud, that I don't think anybody questions that the court acted lawlessly in disregarding, writing out of the federal rules, Rule 9B, which says that fraud, among other things, and states of mind can be averred generally. And if there's any doubt about what the people who wrote that rule intended, it's settled by their note, because their note refers to the English rule, and the English rule makes it quite clear that it means what it says. You don't have to plead any facts when you're alleging a state of mind. And they simply disregarded that, because if they hadn't, they wouldn't have been able to reach the result. And I agree in some respects with Adam's take on this. I mean, note that they rewrote the law of official immunity, even though the petitioners had conceded some form of vicarious liability. They conceded it, and nonetheless, the court couldn't have reached the result it did unless they'd rewritten the law of official immunity. So if you want to find a teleological decision, Iqbal is it.
And if I could just add to your first hypothetical about the patent case, and I think that this is how my approach would handle the state of mind issue. In Swierkiewicz and in Iqbal, it wasn't the fact that the state of mind was alleged in a conclusory fashion. That doesn't make something transactionally conclusory, and that's consistent with 9B. It's okay to allege state of mind generally. The problem in Iqbal, and it was not a problem in Swierkiewicz, was the failure to adequately identify what they did with that bad intent. It was the ambiguity about what exactly Ashcroft and Mueller's role was. So I think in the patent context, the way you'd want to argue it is to say, principle. I can allege this state of mind generally, and here's what they did with that state of mind. They failed to disclose X. And I would say that would be non-conclusory, ergo it has to be accepted as true without regard to plausibility, without regard to whether there's actually proof yet.
And going to your other question, what I did was I looked at all the different common law procedures and then sort of As I sort of said in the presentation, looked at the modern procedure and compared them to the common law procedures, but then also derived what the substance of the common law was. I didn't import sort of what we do under the modern system. And the reason I think that that's appropriate is that, you know, the Seventh Amendment is the only place in the Constitution to refer to common law explicitly. And certainly the Supreme Court has said that, you know, originalism applies generally in the context of the Constitution and has used it a lot, and he's used it a lot, especially in the context of the other jury trial provision, the Sixth Amendment. And so And I'll also sort of say that you set up in the Seventh Amendment sort of this division of power between the jury and the judge. And if it isn't something that's sort of somewhat set in some form, then it's more difficult or more easy for judges, in fact, to sort of impinge or to impede on that power. So that's why I sort of start with the common law. I think there can be criticisms clearly to that, and I think some of what you're saying goes to that, where you could say, well, we have this modern procedural system that has deviated somewhat from this common law system, and so therefore, don't we have to go around that? And I think that there's definitely something to be said about that. But we're so far from the common law system, given and what we actually have as our mandate, that I think we need to actually go back the other way before we kind of worry too much about the modern system.
So I think I will exercise my prerogative as the moderator to ask a question. And I'll direct it primarily towards Professor Burbank, but of course, any of you are welcome to jump in. I'm wondering what is left of heightened pleading after Twombly and Iqbal. So we've heard the term heightened pleading bantered around quite a bit here, and we know that it exists in its actual form in Rule 9b and also in the PSLRA, and that's where plaintiffs are required to plead with particularity when they their cause of action involves fraud or mistake, or in the PSLRA for certain securities class actions. But Professor Burbank, you mentioned that in some of the decisions you've been reading, particularly from the 6th and 11th Circuit, that those lower courts seem to be invoking or applying a heightened pleading standard. So I was wondering if you've noticed any difference between the heightened pleading standard as we know it in its formal sense from Rule 9 and the PSLRA, and heightened pleading in the more sort of informal or colloquial sense that some people have said Twombly and Iqbal implies. As we've seen, there's tremendous disagreement about what exactly those cases mean and what they require, and is it heightened pleading? But what is it that you've seen in the lower courts?
I think what I've seen in the lower courts is largely what was going on in a number of lower courts prior to Twombly and Iqbal, and it is occurring because of the power that the court now has formally given to the lower courts to disregard certain allegations in complaints as conclusory. The greater the freedom of a district court judge to disregard allegations in the complaint as conclusory, the more facts, sparing my colleague's presence, the more facts that district judge is requiring. Now, the district judge, if taxed with requiring heightened pleading, would say, no, I'm not requiring heightened pleading, that's different. Well, I mean, I'm not so sure that it is different. The point is that we are, I think, without admitting it, getting back to a system of fact pleading, very much like the one that was explicitly rejected by the people who wrote the federal rules. Now, that may be what we need to do, although do note, in connection with one of the points that Professor Sherry made, that the to whether there are problems in discovery and whether they are problems that are sufficiently great to concern us. So it is rather bizarre to me that we should approach it in this way. But note that the result is that people with putatively meritorious claims who don't have the ability to get the information because it's in the defendant's files, or don't have the ability to get the information because their lawyer is working on a contingency and doesn't have the ability to spend the fortune that would be required to discover the information without formal discovery, won't be able to come up with it. So we are getting fact pleading, and whether you want to call it heightened pleading, I don't think really makes any difference. It's requiring many more facts in complaints to survive a motion to dismiss than were required prior to Twombly and Iqbal by the Supreme Court, although not by some lower courts.
Actually, I think it's worse than fact pleading. I mean, and worse in the following
because
sense.
Because of plausibility.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think we're getting fact pleading. And if we were, I'm not sure what I would think about that. But at least we know what fact pleading is because we lived with it for 100 years or so. The bigger problem with what we've got now is that we don't know what it is. It's something completely new. It's plausibility, whatever that means, and conclusory. And I, to some extent, maybe the idea of conclusory is going back to distinguishing between facts and law, but I don't think that's all of it. What I think we've got, and here I think Suja is right, is that we've essentially got early summary judgment. We've now got summary judgment before discovery. Judges are evaluating a complaint and looking at it and saying, do I think this should go to a jury, yes or no? And that's what they do with summary judgment, only it's now moved back to before discovery. That's not a system we've ever lived with, whether it's a good system or not. It's just creating disruption because we don't know what it is.
And, you know, and I'll add to that that a number of complaints now are, you know, 30, 40 pages, which kind of seems to indicate that that's the kind of analysis that's going to occur now.
And it goes great to what one of your points, Suzanne, about the about how the cost may well go up, right? Because now plaintiffs have the incentive to pack everything they can into these complaints in the hopes of satisfying this amorphous standard. And, you know, lo and behold, if they make it past that, now the defendant has to answer every single one of those allegations, that there could be hundreds of them. You know, are we really ending up ahead of the ahead here in terms of costs?
Other questions? Well, it is just about 3:15, so despite starting late, I have you all back on schedule. Thank you very much to our panelists.